Call to order this meeting of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee, Wednesday, March 25th, 2009. You have the minutes before you. Are there any corrections? Senator Vickerman moves approval of the minutes of March 23rd, 2009. All who may be in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendments are approved. We're first going to take Senate File 1004. Senator Scheid.
Excuse me. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, thank you. And
we're
pleased
Mr. Joachim
to hear, is going to try to get out here.
Senate File 1004. And the bill, if you would explain what brings the bill to this committee, since it is not the committee of origin. And I do note that you have an amendment. If you would just give us a little background on the bill, why it's here, then we can discuss the amendment and have you on your way.
And Madam Chair, it's here because it includes rulemaking authority. I'm assuming that's why you asked for it.
Yes, Senator Scheid, that's why it's before us,
okay.
Rulemaking. So if you would direct us to that section.
Okay, let me tell you. The bill concerns state construction codes and licensing provisions. So it has to do with building code. And let's see, I think that if Section 3 has rules, so that is page 2.
Okay, so it's section 3.
Having to do with the plumbing board. Okay.
And then,
then section 9.
And I see in through here, just as a question that you are, and then there, and section 17 has to do with rules. I noticed that you are allowing the rulemaking by the plumbing board itself rather than the commissioner and changing some of the responsibilities away from the commissioner to the plumbing board. Would you like to speak a little bit to that?
Madam Chair, that's correct, and I'm going to ask Mr. Joachim.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself we welcome your testimony. I'd also like you to talk a little bit about Section 7 of the bill.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Joachim.
Good evening, members. I'm Tom Joachim, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Labor and Industry. This is a cleanup to the cleanup to our large code bill of 2 years ago. And as we are going through this, piecing it all together, we are finding pieces that needed to be corrected. And for example, on Section 3 is there's a section that last year was passed by Senator Bach that addressed the state building code as the standard across the state.
Mm-hmm.
And the language, specific language in the plumbing law stated that if you're on a septic system and a well system, you're not required to comply to the plumbing code. Well, if we have the code applicable as a standard across the state, we need to make sure the plumbing code is included in part of that. So this is just a cleanup to address that.
And the plumbing board was already doing those rules anyway.
Yes, they
okay.
were. And then your question about responsibilities in some of the other sections, we're just clarifying with 2 years ago, we established an authoritative plumbing board, high-pressure piping board, and electrical board to address those specific codes. And there was language that they are responsible for the licensure of their industry and the code that they adopt, and then the department is responsible for the inspections and enforcement of those licenses and of the codes that are in place.
And Mr. Joachim, did you have to make those changes for the other boards as well, or just for the plumbing board?
Madam Chair, committee members, for all the other boards, we had to make similar type changes. So some of the language in here is just catching the ones we missed 2 years ago to lay them all out the same way.
Okay, and then Section 7 adds counties to cities and towns in terms of having the authority to adopt local regulations. So is that just something you missed as well?
Madam Chair, committee members, yes, it is.
Are there any questions? And then on section 9, there were rules as well, changing that from commissioner to plumbing board in the same way. And then in the last section of the bill,
14.
It directs the plumbing board to amend its rules to conform with the statutes and as would be amended by the passage of this bill. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, correct.
Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. Joachim or Commissioner or Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair.
And then there is the there is the A1 amendment. Any questions so far on this? Senator Betzel?
No, I was going to ask about the A1 amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel moves the A1 amendment. Can you explain that to us a bit?
Madam Chair, yes, I can.
You have a copy of it?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yes, I do.
And for members, it's in your packet.
We have it. Okay.
Okay. And let me give you the background to why the cities feel they need this change. I'm just going to read from something that I got from the League of Cities. The City of Mankato has a city ordinance that requires all exterior work authorized by a building permit to be completed within 18 months. Well, you know there are a lot of uncompleted, unfinished structures around in for probably all of our communities. And they have to, the permit holder has to get a request an extension. The Minnesota Court of Appeals ruled that the city code was preempted by the state building code because they determined, though the state building code doesn't include an explicit deadline, it does regulate construction time limits related to commencement and suspension. So League of Cities would like to see, because cities are seeing more and more unfinished structures because of the foreclosures, it's to allow cities to adopt an ordinance that requires exterior work. I mean, some of these things, I'm sure you've seen them around your town. They would be able to adopt an ordinance that requires that the exterior work be completed in a certain number of days, but no sooner than 180 days or 6 months. They can't require it. And I think that if a builder has some unforeseen hardship and they can't do it within that 6 months, they could always go and request an extension. But this will help cities avoid the blight that goes along with unfinished construction. And also, I think, protect the public because you have some of these structures are open. In fact, I think many are, and that are sitting around unfinished. So that is the genesis of that.
Of questions this A1 for amendment. Senator Scheid on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, Senator Betzel renews his motion that the A1 amendment be approved. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Betzel, is there anyone who wishes to speak in favor or in opposition to Senate File 1004?
Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel.
I do want to save Senator Frederickson some time on the Senate floor when this bill comes up. If you look at page 7, line 5,
typo.
It says no such city, county, or town. And
page 7, did you say?
I'm sorry, page 5, line 7. Page 5, line 7. I reversed it. Page 5, line 7.
No
such city. And I think Senator Frederickson would not be very pleased to see that. So on behalf of Senator Frederickson, I move to delete the word such.
Senator Betzel on line 5.7 moves to delete the word, to strike the word such. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In Section 3, it says that the Plumbing Board's authority is expanded to include new installations in private homes that have private wells and septic systems, which they didn't previously have authority over. Who did have authority over that?
Mr. Joachim.
Madam Chair, Senator, nobody did. In our state building code application, state building code applies in the communities that choose to administer and enforce the code. Last year, Senator Bach established it as the standard across the state so that the homeowners and builders that were building in the non-administered area were still required to build to the code, but there's nobody there to administer it. That might be something that comes out in the future, or those cities choose to in the future to choose to enforce it. But this application, there was no requirement for the homeowner to comply to the code. They had to have a licensed well driller install a well. They had to have a licensed septic system installer install the septic system, but they could do anything they wanted inside their home for the plumbing system. And this just clarifies that that's part of the state building code, that even though there's nobody out there to inspect it right now, at least they're required to install it to the standard. And if they sell it to somebody and somebody goes to court and said plumbing system isn't working and you installed it wrong, now they'd have some mechanism to go back to say they should have installed it to the minimum standard of our state plumbing code.
Any other questions or comments? Anybody else want to testify in support or in opposition of this bill? Seeing none, Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 1004, as amended, be recommended to pass. All who may be in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much,
Madam Chair, Senator Committee, Shai. Thank you.
No problem. Is Senator Cohen here? Senator Bono? Senator Sieben moves the adoption of the subcommittee report on Senate File 260. All who are in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have Senate File 260 before us as amended by the subcommittee. Senator Vonoff, if you'd like to briefly describe the bill. We had extensive testimony on it in the subcommittee. If anybody feels a burning desire to testify, we'll receive that, but if not, we'll move on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. And because we have had that testimony, I didn't plan to have any testifiers here today. And this Senate File 260 essentially moves the primary from September to June. And most of the bill then has conforming changes that, because of that change in statute, are required to make the whole system work. Things like how it relates to the absentee ballots and how it relates to giving notice to people. I am carrying this bill, and I know many have carried it before me. I know there were many years of the GROW Commission that worked on this issue. And let me just say that I think the time has finally come for us to make this change in Minnesota, that we know that the more people that are engaged in this process, the better outcomes we will have with regard to our elected representatives, and that by having the primary in September, we are in fact hurting that process. Number one, imagine if we had a recount after a primary like we've seen a recount with the general election. There would be no way to even have our general election in time if that were to happen. Imagine, you know, the disappointment by those military members that were not allowed to have their vote counted because they didn't have sufficient time to get their ballots in. But most importantly, let me go back to what it's like. You know, we have a caucus system, and this bill does not say whether or not the caucus system is a good system or a bad system. But we do have a caucus system that endorses candidates. And the public does not really weigh in, for the most part, in that process. It's a very small, select group that makes that determination. And so there are oftentimes challengers who would like to go before the public to say, I'm a better candidate. When you have a September primary, you are literally saying that unless you can self-finance, that is not possible. To spend all summer campaigning against an opponent in your party leaves a candidate in September with very little resources to then go back and compete in the general election in November. In addition, oftentimes, a challenger is concerned about the damage that it will cause to his or her own party in terms of having a strong candidate emerge from the primary when the elections are so close together. So because of that and many other reasons that have been made public over the years, I am moving that we do make this change and have the primary move from September to June.
Senator Sieben, would you want to raise an issue?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, we did speak about this briefly, but I do have concern that we're moving the absentee voting in person up to 45 days before the election. I understand the concerns about the need to accommodate military voters, but I do have some concern about moving everyone else to voting up to 45 days before the election.
So, Senator Bonoff, I think we had discussed that with you and in other bills as well, and so to move the in-person to conform to other bills. Senator Sieben, is that correct? Is it 30 days or was it less?
What was your question?
In-person absentee balloting.
30 days.
30 days. Senator Bonoff, that's in Section 6. Senator Sieben, you have my copy of the bill. Would you indicate
Madam Chair, that is acceptable to me, and I would accept that as an amendment.
Okay, so I think that would be the only place that refers to absentee balloting in person. So on line 3.32, Senator Sieben moves to strike the new language and insert strike the new language. And what do you have to do there?
Madam Chair, I think it would be as simple as simply deleting Section 6 from the bill, and you'd go back to existing law, which would be 30 days before the election.
Okay, before any elections. Right. So the motion will be from Senator Sieben to delete Section 6, and then that makes them all 30 days. And
Madam Chair, that's fine.
On other times, we are allowing the 45 day for the mailing out of the of the ballots, and particularly because of the overseas military.
Madam
sure
Chair, that's correct. We wanted to keep the mail in to preserve the opportunity for the military.
You'd be able to do that for both the what do you call it? Both primary
the primary and
the
general.
And the general. Okay, so that would be the only amendment offered then here. Senator Sieben moves to delete Section 6. Any questions about that amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion of Senate File 260? Senator Betzel?
I just have a technical question so I can understand it. In Section 7, that backs up the dates when the candidates have to file their affidavits of candidacy and nominating petitions. What time frame would that be? And it sounds like it'd be like, what, early March when they'd have to file that in order for a June primary? I'm just trying to figure out when that would be.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, I believe it would be early March.
Okay, thank you.
And we did make, I think in the subcommittee, there were conforming changes to make sure that the campaign finance laws worked correctly.
Yes. And Madam Chair, Mr. Goldsmith was not able to be here with us today, so he's not available for questions on that, but can follow up.
He did testify to that.
Yes, yes. And for members who weren't on the subcommittee, we did have the party chair of the DFL. We had Chuck Slocum, who was a former GOP chair, testify, and then we've now got commitment from the Independence Party. He couldn't be here today, but he wanted everybody to know the Independence Party is also supportive of this change.
Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bonoff, if we have filing in early March, does that include all of the races for everything that will be on the November ballot for county commissioner, school board, city council, townships that have November elections? All of those things would have to be filed in March.
Madam Chair, anything that would be subject to a primary, yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I think that poses several dilemmas because there's a lot of people who have not made decisions that early on whether or not they're going to seek another seat in November. But even today when we were talking about redistricting and we were talking about how the redistricting maps would get finished and when they would get finished, we were trying to figure out if they would be done in time for precinct caucuses in 2012. And now it would not only be precinct caucuses we'd have to worry about, it would be whether or not people could file for the seats if the plan that Senator Pogemiller has would be implemented and the third map wouldn't be presented until 2012 to the legislature. That's a whole nother issue. It's kind of traveling at the same time as this one, but it's a possibility that we wouldn't even know what our maps were in early March when people would be expected to file. The other issue that I have a concern with is that legislators are really in the heat of session during this time when filings would be expected to occur. And I guess it troubles me to think that our process would probably become a whole lot more political. Once everybody knew who their opponents might be and what was going on at home, that it would just be a lot more difficult here to finish the session we were in that, during that election cycle before adjournment. And we've never had filings before adjournment. And I think that could cause a lot of problems. But my biggest concern is just extending the election season for that many more months. People are so tired of campaigns. I have heard of people say, why don't we do something like the Europeans do and have like a 6-week campaign and just get it over with and not draw these things out and spend all that money on them. And I think that by pushing back, instead of saving money, we may actually be spending more money because we just have a longer period of which to campaign in the general election and spend a lot more resources. And so I am not a supporter of the early primary, and I just don't like the idea of extending the campaign season any more than it already is.
Okay, are there any other questions or comments for Senator Bonoff? Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, I actually don't think the campaign is extended under this proposal. I just think the focus is a little different. Instead of it being a primary focus over the summer, it's more of a general election focus. But I don't really think that, I think that's the major difference here.
Madam Chair, I just also wanted to just comment to Senator Roebling that in my earlier testimony, I too brought up the European model and said I wish it were that. But I can tell you that with this September primary, the campaign season is happening. Again, it's just not engaging the wider number of people who have a right, really, to voice an opinion, should there be. And with regard to our own elections, I would be interested in how many times legislators have actually had a primary opponent. It's pretty expensive to run in a primary against somebody, and I'm not certain that, in fact, legislators, I just would be surprised how many times. I don't know. I don't know that answer. I guess you should never raise a question you don't know the answer to. But
any further discussion on Senate File 260? Anyone in the audience wish to testify who did not testify in favor or in opposition to the bill in the subcommittee? Seeing none, Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 260 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Benoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen, thought I saw him here. He was here.
We're all.
Senator Metzen here.
Me too.
I know, I'm coming to her. I'm just going down the list. Senator Moore.
Thank you.
Senator Moore brings us 562 and the issue in 562.
Section 2 of the bill, Madam Chair.
I'm just looking for it. I don't see my copy of it.
Madam Chair,
While everyone is shuffling, yes. Council has recommended an A5 technical amendment that does a cross-reference.
Senator, well, we're going to have another amendment instead first. Senator, this bill, there was an amendment added which brought it here, and that is Section 2, which deals with the Racing Commission. And otherwise, the bill would not have come here, and we're going to... Lori, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move we strike Section 2.
Senator Lori moves we strike Section 2.
Okay.
Section 2 refers to the ability of the Racing Commission to hire people who otherwise would be disqualified because they have been convicted of a felony, as I recall. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. And members, we're just a little bit concerned. Yeah, a felony. A little bit concerned that because it does involve the Racing Commission and MAME's gaming operations, that this bill could become a vehicle for otherwise unrelated bills or amendments dealing with gambling. So we're going to, Senator Lori has moved to remove it here. However, it will certainly be germane on the floor to add this provision back to the bill. I'm trying to be totally transparent here. Back to the bill, but when it's added back to the bill, it could not serve as a bridge amendment to other gambling or to gambling issues. So that's it's not trying to keep the Racing Commission from doing from having these folks work behind the scenes at the track. Last year, we didn't have a vehicle that it would be appropriate for, and so we turned them down on that. But I think the process I've just outlined will should work for them. Any questions on the Lori amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Why are we afraid of having a vehicle for gambling bills? I mean, I noticed that we haven't been hearing any gambling bills. I'm on the gambling subcommittee, and we haven't even had a meeting yet.
That's correct.
And I know there's bills out there that could be heard.
And we're not going to hear them. Except with one exception, and that is if things have been worked out in the House, we will hear the charitable gambling bill that was recommended to solve some issues for the charities that they've worked with, and we'll hear that report as well.
Madam Chair?
Senator Day, go for it.
To Senator Roebling, the legislature, we don't control gambling. Gambling is in the hands of a small minority group of people that basically control the legislature. So therefore, that's why we don't have any gambling bills.
Okay, are there any questions for Senator Lori on the motion to delete Section 2? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? No. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Moore, we will take the A5 amendment to the floor with regard to that section and let Senator Scheid know what happened. So we have now Senate File 562 before us, I'm assuming as amended, and Senator Bickerman moves Senate File 562 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Okay. Senator Cohen. Senator Cohen brings us Senate File 2. This is the Committee of Origin. Senator Cohen, do you have any office amendments?
I know the truth.
Madam Chair, there's no.
That's fine. Would you like to explain your bill then,
sure,
please?
Sure. Madam Chair, members, the committee has actually heard this bill, or most of this bill previously. This is the budget reform bill we attempted to pass last year, and continuing to see if we could be a little bit more successful. We got a good piece of this to the governor's desk. He vetoed the bill. Some of this is the same language. Some of it's different language. And, Madam Chair and members, what's attempted with this legislation is to provide what I think will be a better framework for budget decisions within the legislature. So some of it involves work on the part of the Legislative Commission, fiscal policy and planning. Some of it involves fiscal notes. We have whistleblower language in here. Madam Chair, I think maybe the easiest thing is just to try to briefly go through the bill. And I'm not sure, again, members have basically heard a lot of this. There was significant discussion.
Just maybe briefly some of the major provisions then,
okay.
Senator.
Well.
Or is anything different from what we've heard before? Maybe concentrate on those sections.
Okay, well, there is the one significant change. Two changes. The first is language on page 5 of the bill, section 9, and that relates to duties and rights of classified employees. This is legislation that Senator Olson has worked on.
Senator Olson M.?
Yes, mm-hmm. And Madam Chair, I'll be honest with you. Some of this language needs to be worked on in terms of the verbiage, which I've not had the chance to do. My intent would be, if the committee refers the bill to the Finance Committee, to bring in some language that would clean up what I think is a little bit of awkward wording. But what it attempts to do is to make sure that state employees are available to not just simply the executive branch, but the legislature as well. I think it's been an ongoing fight with lots of governors, and this goes back to my first term, Governor Perpich, where there's always an issue as to whether or not we have access to executive branch employees who are not direct employees of the governor, not the governor's staff, not the governor's commissioners, not people directly under the hire and employment of the governor, but the people who are people, individuals in the classified service, and whether or not they have some obligation to offer some help to the legislative branch. So this provides clarification. Again, I think the language has to be cleaned up a little bit. The second piece of new language is on page 6, section 11, which sets up a working group, and this would be an executive legislative group, to take a look at the budget information and see whether or not the present documents we have are working. This is meant to be an interim project that would involve staff, and it indicates designees of Senate Finance and House Ways and Means. I would anticipate the work done through this working group would all likelihood be at a staff level. Mr. Mossman would be involved, I assume Ms. Novak in the House, designees from the Department of Management and Budget. And this is meant to be an effort to streamline the budget process. I would also expect that this language would allow for a recodification of some of the budgetary language that we have in statute. At this point, we have the language kind of spread around different parts of the statute, and we should really make an effort to recodify and put everything in the same section of statute. So that's what's intended by Section 11. The repealer simply repeals some obsolete language, budget reserve language that makes reference to 2003. So those are the new parts of the bill. Again, I can answer questions about those sections or what we're attempting to do again in the rest of the bill.
So, Senator Cohen, in Section 11, you are, since the Commissioner of Finance is convening the group, you are comfortable with him deciding who those people are going to be.
Well, Madam Chair, the Commissioner of Finance can certainly decide who would be involved in terms of executive branch employees. But remember, it says designees of the chairs of Senate Finance and House of Representatives, Ways and Means, including representatives of both majority and minority parties. So if it was determined that this was going to be done at a staff level, which is what I would anticipate, we would go to Senator Senjum and say, would you like to have a staff designee? I would certainly anticipate nonpartisan staff would be significantly involved. But it does call for the appointment and involvement of legislative employees.
Senator Cohen, you have a date by which the Commissioner of Finance would convene it. I wonder if I see a couple of things that might help the process along. Number one, if the representatives, including that the members of the working group that would include the designees of the legislative leaders achieved by July 1 so that they're ready to serve. Secondly, in line 626, 627, I think that the work of the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy would be made easier if the working group would be making recommendations that included draft language of legislation. Yeah. We've added that. And then a third change is we would need an expiration date for the working group, and I would I don't know what you want to suggest, maybe the end of the year or the date on which the report, including draft language, is presented to the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy.
I would think the latter might make some sense.
That would expire on the date that the report is made, and what that does is to cover if for some reason by December 10th that report is not done, the working group still exists until the report is actually filed.
That would be fine, Madam Chair.
Mr. Bodern, can you give us a couple amendments one amendment to take care of those concerns?
Madam Chair, I think the first concern, which was the deadline for appointments from the legislative branch or the designations, that could be addressed, but with an amendment that would require on page 6 after line 23, insert, the appointing authorities from the legislative branch must complete their designations by July 1st, 2009.
Okay. Senator Sieben moves adoption of that amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted.
And then, Madam Chair, on page 6, line 26, after recommendations, insert, comma, including draft legislation if necessary, comma.
Senator Sieben moves adoption of that amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And then the expiration?
And, Madam Chair, that would be on page 6, line 30, after the period, insert, the working group expires when the commissioner submits the report required by this section.
Senator Sieben moves adoption of that amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion on Senate file, number 2, or questions of Senator Cohen?
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I'll note in Section 10, this is the whistleblower provision, and Senator Mary Olson has this exact proposal, which has already been to this committee, and it's already been through Judiciary, as a matter of fact, and we've changed the wording of it both in this committee, and I think Judiciary adopted the language as it is, but I just want to call to Senator Cohen's attention that we've made some changes into this proposal, and he may want to, perhaps is in finance tomorrow, we may just want to amend the language to reflect what this committee has changed in that area so that we don't have two different bills dealing with the same topic worded different ways.
Senator Cohen?
Madam Chair, I did not realize that, but I think if that's the case, Senator Betzel's point is a good one. So I'm not prepared to I can't offer the language here, but would be happy to conform this language to any other legislation.
Senator Cohen, we don't we don't have that language before us either.
Right.
So,
it
does reflect the work of this committee, and we would hope that you would change this bill to reflect the work of the committee done on Senator Olson's bill.
Madam Chair, that's what I was going to say, that before the bills heard in finance have passed out of this committee, I would have an amendment in the finance committee that would reflect the language from this committee. And I'll, when I go back across the hall, I'll make sure that we get that ready.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Anybody else want to speak in favor or in opposition to this bill?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Bonner, sorry.
I do have the language from the first engrossment of Senator Olson's bill in front of me, and I think you could take care of it fairly quickly with an amendment
here. Senator Cohen will do it here then, and then the bill will be in shape. Mr. Bonner, sorry.
Madam Chair, on page 6, line 13, you delete an employee in the legislative branch and insert the legislative auditor. And then on page 6, line 14, delete an elected official in the executive branch and insert a constitutional officer.
So line 13 would read what?
Line 13 should read a legislator or the legislative auditor or.
So an employee. Would be reporting to a legislator, the legislative auditor, or a constitutional officer.
Correct.
Senator Betzel.
I'll also move, Madam
moves
Chair.
Adoption of that language, which brings it into conformity with the Senator Mary Olson bill. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Anything further on Senate File 2? Mr. Yoker. I'll call on you, Senator Pickerman. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Kurt Yoakum with Minnesota Management and Budget. I won't take much of the committee's time this morning. It just as Senator Cohen already mentioned, this language is very similar to legislation that the governor vetoed last year. I believe that the administration still has very similar concerns to what they did last year. The only other item that I'm going to bring up is that this committee has heard MMB's testimony already on the expansion and broadening of the whistleblower protections. Assistant Commissioner Paul Larson spoke to this committee and both the Judiciary Committee, and those are still concerns. And so I just, for the record, wanted to put those forward. Thank you.
Okay. So noted. Any other comments? Senator Vickerman then moves that Senate File 2, as amended, be recommended to pass. All in favor of that? Yes. And refer to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails. And the
Madam Chair members, thank you.
Bill is referred to the Committee on Finance. Is Senator Metzen here? Senator Metzen brings us Senate File 1036. This is the ratification of labor agreements and compensation plans. Senator Metzen, if you want to
thank
summarize
you, Senator
it
Rest, and members,
briefly, that would be fine with us.
Yeah, Senate File 1036 is the what's left over of the labor ratification contracts from last year. You may recall last year we ratified maybe 95-97% of the contracts. These are the three or four that were left over, and one was for the executive branch. And by the way, these have all been reviewed by the LCC and Subcommittee on Employee Relations, and Senator Betzel is on there, and I know Senator Rest, you were on there at one time, and maybe Senator Pappas and others, but these were negotiated. Like I said, most of them were ratified a year and a half ago. Again, these are the remaining ones. There's one, some of it deals with the State University Administrative and Service Facility, faculty, I should say, doctors and specialized services working in state facilities in greater Minnesota. Section 4, 5, and 6 deals with the State Pension Fund Board for their directors. And there's a Subdivision 7. We were playing some catch-up on the State Board of Investment group. We've got pretty much documented that we are way, way under funding or underpaying our people on the investment board, and this and the administration agrees with us that this step has to be taken for the State Board of Investment. And then we go on to talk about the nurses. We that came as an arbitration award, and that's 3.2%, 3.25, like many of the other contracts from the last session. And the new compensation plan for the Office of the Legislative Auditor. So, again, these were approved by the administration and also our committee on employee relations. So we've been very well discussed, and I know Mr. Hubinger is here, too. I think there's an amendment. There's a couple of things that have been done this.
This is the committee of origin. There is the A1 amendment. Senator Carlson moves the A1 amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
I think that, unless there's further questions, I think,
adopted.
Again.
Just a second. I have to adopt the amendment. And the amendment is adopted. And Senator Metzen, would you just, now that we've adopted, would you just explain what that amendment does, the A1
that
amendment?
That's one we approved last week. State interfaculty organization relations.
This one just comes late to it because it was just done on March 23rd.
Well, we just did this. Right? Maybe Mr. Hubinger would very briefly explain. This is a new one for this year.
Mr. Hubinger, the A1 amendment.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission and Subcommittee on Employee Relations. As Senator Metzen indicated, this labor contract is for the State University faculty. It's for the next biennium that begins on July 1, and it freezes steps and lanes for the faculty and otherwise keeps them whole.
Okay. Are there any questions on Senate file?
Madam Chair.
1036. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, I understand that the community college faculty have also approved their contract or are close to it. Is that going to be in a separate bill or?
Yeah, we want to move this one, Senator Rest and Senator Pappas, because this is the last year stuff.
Yeah.
And, yes, we will be in the next month or so ratifying the other units. But we did catch this one for this year into this one. That's the amendment. But 99% of the other contractual stuff will be in the next
bill.
Next bill. Okay. Yeah. Good question. Yeah.
Any further questions? Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Metzen, it was my, I believe we, when we heard this issue last Monday, I don't know that there's any more contracts to be approved during this legislative session. I think everything else is coming after the session. And so this is going to be the last one we see during the session.
Well, Ms.
Okay.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I just asked that question about the community college faculty because I think they're going to approve their contract shortly.
Senator Metzen?
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is maybe they might do stuff earlier just to show some good faith or something. Did I read that, or is that part of it?
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Very similar to IFO is I think they're going to roll over their contract with minimal changes.
Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, there is a tentative agreement with a two-year faculty that's being ratified by the membership and has to go to the Minsky board. It's unlikely that that will get to the legislature before we adjourn.
But, Madam Chair, we'll see we'll see the intent, though, I'm sure, like you brought up. Yeah.
Any other questions or comments for Senator Metzen? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 1036, the ratification of state contracts, labor contracts? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank
you very much.
I'm sorry. You need the bill to go to finance.
Yeah.
Senator Sieben, reconsider the previous motion. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 1036, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All who may be in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much.
Okie dokie. Senator Bach here. Senator Bach is currently in a conference committee. Senator Roebling, where is she? Is she here? I would take her bill next. Senator Roebling's bill? You know where she wants? her shoes.
Actually, it's actually room 15, but I don't know that she's there. You're looking for roll book? Education's in room 15.
We want to, let's see, who here is on that bill with her? Okay, but we can take care of this other one. Senator Lori, do you mind acting on behalf of Senator Roebling so we can take this bill up? It needs to go to another committee.
Sure.
Well, if she gets here, I don't want to waste your time.
I'm on it.
Yeah, Senator Lori is a first co-author. This is a bill that does need to go to judiciary and to get reported, so we want to move on it. I don't believe, Mr. Bodden, are there any amendments on behalf of the author?
Madam Chair and members, I've got Senate File 1662 on
this is a firefighter services advisory task force.
Yeah, task force changes. I've got Kent Sulem from the townships and Buck from the Ambulance Association to explain the bill.
Mr. Sulem?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kent Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. This is a bill that was brought forward through our legislative committee process. And what we've been seeing in recent years are that fire service contracts in the rural areas are just skyrocketing costs. A couple years ago, we were seeing them double in 1 year, then it started to triple. And this last year, we've had situations where they've quadrupled. We had a community in the Southwest Metro that had their fire contract go from about 35,000 a year to 120-some thousand in less than a two-year period. And we're just very concerned that we're pricing communities out of being able to afford fire services. And one of the things we've also seen is that as LGA is cut, service contracts go up. It's being used as an offset. We didn't want to come in making any specific recommendations, but we know there's a host of things that are going on around the state that help contain costs, that look at creative ways of providing services. And so we thought it would just be very beneficial to bring a group together that could identify a variety of ideas, a variety of best practices, look at how service contracts are negotiated, and try to maybe bring forth some recommendations next year, or at least identify in a bit more uniform way how things are being handled across the state. This is primarily a rural issue, although there are some of the near metro communities that are affected, and that's why we, when we worked with the League of Cities and the Small Cities Association and the firefighter groups, that's how we arrived at the membership for the task force. It's how we arrived at the population thresholds to make sure that there was good representation for those that this is really targeted at. And so, again, we're not trying to force anything. We're not making specific recommendations. We're just saying, let's get the right people together in the room, have a couple of meetings, see if we can come up with some good solutions, figure out how to best provide services. One of the consequences we've had this year was that we had two communities outside the Ely area that finally said, we cannot afford these service contracts. We'll just go without fire protection. Well, that's fire protection is not required by state law, but it does pose a number of problems in terms of when 911 gets the call, they don't know about the existence of contracts or not. Medical services and ambulance services, as Mr. McAlpin can attest to, they still have to go out. And so if we can find ways to resolve these conflicts and have better guidance, we just think the state would be better served, the locals would be better served. Mr. Engstrom could not stay. He had other conflicts, but he wanted to let you know that the Small Cities Association is fully supportive of this. We have met with the Fire Chiefs Association. They've been very supportive of this effort. I've yet to have anybody tell me that they're in opposition.
Senator Roebling, we had a small break, and so Senator Bach's bill is going to take some time, so we decided to move you up in the agenda, and I asked Senator Lori, who is a co-author on your bill, to begin the presentation. But we'll, Senator Lori, you can return to your chair.
Well, I wasn't sure of the rules.
He can stay.
Did a good job.
I like added support here. I appreciate you doing that, so sure. My testifiers don't have to stay very late in case the next bill goes for a long time. I'm sorry I was down in the
That's
education
okay.
committee.
Other committees are meeting. Would you like to testify briefly?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Buck McKelton, President, Minnesota Ambulance Association. We're very interested in this project. Also, we have another similar type first responder pilot we're working on with Senator Lori. The first responders are a very integral part of our ambulance system and how they respond. And funding is obviously a big issue with us, and our association is very interested in working and seeing the outcome of a funding project like this and how we move these services forward in the future.
Senator, there are a couple of amendments to be considered that respond to the guidelines, Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, we tried.
And the membership, I know, and the membership. The first is one that from Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Roebling, we've had the discussion in the past about the appointments from legislative members about the Committee on Rules Administration versus the majority or minority leader, and I think you're well aware. That's why I would I'd like to make a motion that we change the wording of that to correspond with our previous discussions where each caucus leader appoints their members. And Mr. Bodern has, I think, some language to accomplish that.
Mr. Bodern.
Madam Chair, what you would need to do would be on page 1, delete lines 19 and 20, and insert a new clause 1 that would say, two members of the Senate, comma, including one from the majority party, comma, appointed by the majority leader of the Senate, and one from the minority party appointed by the Senate minority leader, semicolon.
And that's already been taken care of in the members that are coming from the House of Representatives. You've heard Senator Gerlach's motion. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And the amendment is adopted. Now, on on page 2, I believe that it's just as simple to say, at the first meeting, the members shall elect rather than appoint by a majority vote. And also, I'm going to ask someone to, Senator Gerlach, to make this motion also. And Senator Roebling, I'd like to suggest that the chair be a non-legislator member, and so that the thing would read, at the first meeting, the members shall elect one of the non-legislator members to be the chair. Senator Gerlach?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All those in favor of that motion, Senator Roebling, is that okay with you?
That's fine with me, Madam Chair.
All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. And then we've been asking again, the task force and working groups, when they make their recommendations, to also send in potential or possible draft legislation, including draft legislation. So on line 217, the task force shall report its finding and any recommendations, including draft legislation, to the legislative committee. So inserting on line 217, the phrase, including draft legislation. Senator Gerlach? Move that.
Yes, Madam Chair. So moved.
Senator Gerlach, I guess Senator Roebling can move it too, but Senator Gerlach moves that amendment as well on line 217. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. And that would come by February 1st of 2010. So that is... that is there. We and the this working group, this task force, would then expire in February, on February 15th or following the submission of the report. So this is a temporary group. Okay. Anyone else wish to testify either in support or in opposition of Senate File 1662? Seeing none, Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 1662 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary. Senate File 1662, as amended, you recommend pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary. Senator Roebling, you know, because there are members of the legislature on this task force, that following judiciary, the bill will need to go to the Rules Committee because there are legislator members. Okay.
Madam Chair, does that give me a problem with the policy deadline or when
no,
we go to rules?
No, if it's in
okay.
Rules Committee, it's met the deadline.
Madam Chair?
Senator,
I've been noticing a lot of bills going to judiciary, yeah. And I'm wondering what's the jurisdiction?
Judiciary Committee has jurisdiction over firefighters and fire services.
Public safety.
In terms of it's public safety.
Okay.
So it's a very correct
jurisdiction is too broad.
So Senator Lurie, once again, Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 1662, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Roebling. Maybe you can do your education stuff. Senator Bach.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach has asked me to offer the A5 amendment.
Senator Bach, Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair.
Offers the A5 amendment. And just for the members in the public's information, it's actually the A6 amendment.
Oops.
Good.
The A6 amendment. Oops.
Before we adopt that, I just want to make people aware that we will take, following this bill, we will take Senate File 1600 next. Okay, that will be next on the list. Senator Pappas, or Senator Bach, do you want to explain what you've done here?
Madam Chair, the A6 amendment is a result of some negotiations I've been trying to conduct between the townships and the cities. It's as close as we are today. It makes some further changes in the Joint Planning Board, the preliminary growth area, and allows for the county board to accept or reject the growth planning or the growth area proposal that's developed by the group of three town and three city planning board, and it allows for an exception to the 1 per 40 acre provision to allow for the opportunity to create development clusters rather than a 1 per 40. So it comes part of the way. I don't want to lead anybody to believe that it gets us all the way so that there's an agreement between the cities in towns, but it gets us closer. So if we can get it on, I think we're closer to an agreement, but there's not peace in the valley yet, as Representative Davids would say over in the House.
Senator Bach, is that the extent of the A6 amendment itself? And did you want people to speak to the A6 amendment or did you want us to vote on it and then?
Oh, Madam Chair, I should say, to the 1 per 40 provision that's in here that there is a great deal of argument about is delayed until August of 2011. That's the other piece in the A6 amendment.
And where does it say that, Senator Bach? Where is the delayed effective date?
Oh, it was part of the package.
It's on lines 2.12 of the amendment. Is that correct?
2.12 is correct.
Okay. Do people have questions on the A6 amendment? Then Senator Pappas has moved the A6 amendment. All those in favor of the A6 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. So now we have this proposal before us. I mean, that...
Madam Chair, and so. Just let me say I really appreciate the effort that, before we take testimony, that the, both the cities and the townships have put into this bill. And this has been an issue, this land use planning issue has been around this place a long time. And the idea of trying to create more dense development and minimize sprawl. And people put a lot of effort into it in previous years, and they put a lot of effort into it this year. This bill has a couple different things in it relative to the school siting that the Education Committee would have to look at and relative to a new TIF proposal that the Tax Committee would have to look at. So what I've asked the groups to do is, and I asked you, Madam Chair, if we could just vote it up or down today and do something with it. There's two more committees for it to go through yet, and my hope is if we could move it out of here. I made a commitment to the townships and the cities that I would try to keep everybody at the table, and if we couldn't find, once we got to the Tax Committee, what we could all agree to, we'd be willing to incorporate in the tax bill, and things that we haven't got agreement on yet would have to wait until next year. So that's my hope, I guess.
Senator Bach, if the committee acted favorably on this proposal now as amended, its next stop would be the Finance Committee.
Correct.
Is that correct? So just so people know that it's not going to the Tax Committee from here if it's acted on favorably.
Correct.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I think there's probably people who want to testify. I know this is a tough time.
So we will take testimony first from people who support the bill.
Madam Chair, my name is Bradley Peterson. I am an attorney and lobbyist with the firm of Flaherty & Hood on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities and have been working on this effort. I just want to point out a couple of things, and then we have two testifiers from various cities to talk about their particular circumstances. First off, I want to thank Senator Bach for bringing this bill. It's an important topic to work on, and I think the bottom line that I hope you all walk away with today is that the status quo, as it is currently being exercised out there in the various townships, counties, and cities, is not acceptable. The status quo is not acceptable. Secondly, I think the bill as amended, the amendments that you put on last week and then just now, reflect, I think, a significant movement from the original bill. There have been a lot of changes that have been made to this bill to accommodate township and county concerns. And some of them, from the city perspective, we have a little bit of trepidation about, frankly, because we're not sure if in practice they'll work from our perspective, but we're willing to give them a try because this is too important to not do anything. And so I just want to bring your attention just briefly to the impetus to this bill was actually some recommendations of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group in terms of how do we meet our greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals. And that group found that doing compact development would help the state towards achieving its goals in the transportation sector. The benefit, frankly, though, of doing a bill like this is that it has other benefits beyond meeting those goals, and one of them is the fact that it gets to the issue of the fact that Minnesota cannot afford, frankly, the cost of what we're doing now. We are losing too much open space and agricultural land relative to our population growth. It is simply too expensive to continue to grow the way that we have and service the developments the way that we have. And the status quo needs to change. And so with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to Jay Blake from the City of Princeton, who would like to talk about their circumstances.
Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record, we'll welcome your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jay Blake, and I'm the Community Development Director for the City of Princeton. I've served in that capacity for the last 3 years and have about 20 years of experience working for all levels of government, including cities, townships, and county-level planning and zoning. My purpose here is to provide you just one city's perspective on what the problems are with the current situation and statutes. Princeton is a great little town of about 4,500 people located northwest of the Twin Cities. It has a lot of opportunities going for it. We've seen some of the growth in the ex-urban area like other communities like Princeton. However, we saw such a rapid growth in the rural residential development over the last 20 years. In fact, most of that growth has been on septic systems and wells. Just to the south of the city of Princeton, we have Baldwin Township. Baldwin has a population of 6,500 people, approximately 2,300 homes on septic systems and wells within their 6x6 area. This development pattern is a factor in our school district having one of the highest transportation costs per pupil of any district in the area. In fact, last night, the Princeton School District was studying their transportation costs in a way to help balance their budget. And what they learned is that their costs per student were $357 per year per student. That is the highest when you compare it to Sauk Rapids, Becker, Big Lake, Buffalo, Cambridge, St. Michael, and Sartell. It is, in one case, more than double the costs of other school districts in transportation costs. And that can be attributed in many ways to the fact that we have 2.5 acre to five acre development from one end of our school district to the other. We're driving school buses down hundreds and hundreds of miles of roads to pick up children that live quite a few miles away from our urban core. Our city is currently planning for urban growth boundaries around our community that are based on our ability to provide sewer and water services. We are not trying to plan from here to eternity. We are trying to be very reasonable about areas that we think will be good growth areas. The map that was handed out in the packet of information shows the proposed city growth boundaries. It was adopted in January of this year as part of our newly adopted comprehensive plan. And in that area, we've decided that that is an area that we can actually serve with the proposed expansion of our city's wastewater and water facilities. Our plan has a comprehensive utilities plan that offers both urban services. It offers compact growth patterns and can be serviced by our facilities. However, the current jumble of statutes makes it very, very difficult for us to protect the areas around our community from rural sprawl. Take, for instance, the Princeton Municipal Airport. It's an area that we've had significant and millions of dollars worth of investment in over the last 25 years. Baldwin Township to the south is currently supporting the development of 183 unit housing development at the end of a future crosswind runway. This particular development also would be put on septic systems and wells, and we're very, very much opposed to this type of development. And so, unfortunately, the way statutes are right now is we have no way to control that. The city doesn't have any direct authority in that area, and we rely simply on the fact of that the county and township may choose to not approve it. This area is also in the Anoka Sand Plain with high water table, certainly not the type of place you'd want to see on-site septic systems. We also recognize that some residents and businesses aren't going to want to have city sewer and water, but we're unfortunately finding that a lot of them are going to need it. An example of that is the Sherburne County Mobile Home Park just south of the city of Princeton. It's had a non-conforming septic system for the last 3 years, and the MPCA is currently forcing them to upgrade their system. What they've discovered is that it will be cheaper for them in the long run to connect to city sewer than to put in their own sewer system and take on the operational costs of that as well. So that particular site is being added to the city of Princeton as an example of things that we're having to go in and fix and correct that have been done wrong over the past 25 or 50 years. In addition, the protection of that airport is a financial crucial item for us. We plan on expanding it. We want it to become a major economic development item in our area, and if we can't do that, it spells the end of the ability to use that. Unfortunately, we are waiting for Baldwin to join us in joint planning. We've made several offers. Baldwin has refused to do so. So we're at the will of the township in trying to protect our future growth areas. Also consider the Princeton Fire Department. The Princeton Fire Department used to serve Baldwin Township. But because of disagreements over annual costs, Baldwin decided we're going to form our own. So they did. They formed the Northeast Sherburne County Fire Department that serves parts of two townships. So instead of paying $60,000 a year for fire service with the Princeton Fire Department, they're now spending over $200,000 a year to have their own. And they currently drive past the Princeton Fire Station to provide service to about a third of their community. Certainly not the wisest use of resources. Currently, our fire department continues to serve six townships in three different counties, and we have a great working relationship with all of those except for one township. In the end, we as a community support legislation that protects our public investments. I believe my city council believes very strongly that we shouldn't be creating duplication of services. And we also want to prevent inefficient development patterns that negatively impact the fiscal and environmental bottom lines of our community. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Would you like to testify, and then we'll have questions?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Patty Gartland. I'm the Sartell City Administrator. I've been serving in that capacity for nearly 8 years now. Prior to coming to the city of Sartell, I worked for the city of St. Cloud, which in Sartell we fondly refer to as our favorite southern suburb. I worked for St. Cloud as their planning director for 13 years. So in my 20-plus years in public service, I've had a pretty extensive amount of experience with urban development and also in working with annexation matters in various forms. I've been actively engaged throughout my career in a lot of the legislative reforms that have been before this body, and it dates as far back as 1992 when then-Senator Randy Kelly chaired a legislative commission that brought forward some legislative reforms, and most recently had served with Senator Olsen and others on the Municipal Boundary Adjustment Task Force. That's a group that spent over a 14-month period. We met 11 different times. We were able to achieve some consensus legislation to do some cleanup work in statute that was approved by the legislature last session. And we recently finished our work by concluding that our ability to achieve any further consensus on the more substantive issues relating to municipal boundary adjustments wasn't going to happen. So we completed our work and are here before you now in our capacity with the city's advocating passage of this particular piece of legislation. From my perspective, in my roles with both the city of St. Cloud and currently with the city of Sartell, the primary issue really that motivates this is improving our abilities to deliver those municipal services in the most cost-efficient, cost-effective manner possible. The reality is the current land use legislation and annexation legislation does not facilitate that. And we've had two very specific situations. City of St. Cloud's St. Cloud Township during the mid-90s, after many years of urban sprawl and failing septic systems, environmental problems, ultimately ended up embarking on a merger agreement that provided for the merger of St. Cloud Township, the predominant part of it, into the city of St. Cloud with a 10-year retrofit plan that the city of St. Cloud committed to retrofit that urban-style development that was being served by private septic and private well systems. That retrofit cost the city of St. Cloud approximately $60 million. Of that, approximately $45 million of that was assessable or paid by the benefiting property owners. But the taxpayers of St. Cloud footed the remainder of that, which exceeded $15 million. So correcting the wrongs of the past was a very expensive proposition for the city of St. Cloud. We are facing a very similar situation in the city of Sartell. We do have an orderly annexation agreement that's been in place since 1992 with the town of Lesaque, which surrounds about two-thirds of our community. Development that was allowed to occur in the township prior to 1992, however, at an urban density is now beginning to have those same kinds of problems that were experienced in St. Cloud Township. We are now being approached by some of those neighborhoods wanting to be annexed into Sartell, wanting to be retrofitted and extended utility services. We've had our engineering firm identify and calculate an estimated cost for us to do that, to extend water, extend sewer, and retrofit those neighborhoods. The cost to do that is estimated at $22 million. And the estimated cost or participation by the benefiting properties is approximately $11 million. That's the extent of what the property owners would be obligated to pay. That leaves an $11 million gap. The reality is the city of Sartell does not have the resources to foot that $11 million gap. We didn't create that problem, and we simply don't have the resources to pay to correct it. Legislation needs to be adopted that precludes that. We think this bill is a good step in that direction. The other experience I'd like to share with you is the situation where City of Sartell is located in two counties. We have firsthand experience at the very different approach that different communities or counties will take towards land use planning and land use controls. Stearns County, Benton County take two very different approaches towards the type of development that they think is appropriate to allow in the urban fringe area. In the city of St. Cloud, that particular city lies in three counties, so three different approaches to it. And I think that just simply makes it even more challenging for cities to try to control or manage what's happening on their boundaries, particularly if we're going to be called to the table at some point in the future to try to retrofit and fix problems that occur. And my final parting comment I want to leave with you is just the example of there is provision in this legislation that talks about school siting and the requirement for school minimum acreage requirement that the state Department of Education has and the impact that that has. We in the city of Sartell experienced that firsthand when our school district embarked on construction of a new elementary school. When they went through the siting process, those standards required them to go quite a distance beyond the developed urban part of the community, and as a result of it, the site they selected, purchased, and proceeded to develop was about a mile and a half from where existing municipal services were available. So they came to the city. The city then was asked to extend those utility services a very long distance to get to their site, and we had to go through undeveloped township area to get there. So it created a very significant cost impact to the city. We fronted that cost. At some point in time, we anticipate there will be infill development and other properties will connect as they see a desire to do that. But in the meantime, we're the ones who had to foot the bill to do that. So my parting or closing comment to you would be to strongly advocate for the sake of the environment, for the sake of cost efficiencies and delivery of public services, that you move forward with adoption of this bill.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gartland. We're going to give some equal time to those who oppose the bill at this point, and then we'll have discussion by the committee. Mr. Sulem, Ms. Garlitz, and Mr. Sherper, and Mr. Siebel. If you all are here, you may want to just come forward, and we'll maybe we can pull up another chair. Welcome to the committee. Who would like to speak first?
I think I'll begin, Mr.
Sulem.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Kent Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. We would like to thank Senator Bach for his work the last several days trying to bring the groups back together and finding if there is a way to build towards better consensus. And I think he's accomplished more in a couple of days than some efforts have done in quite some time. Unfortunately, we are nowhere near a consensus on it. And while the advocates for the bill focus on a number of bad examples of what has happened in the past, many of them, by their own admission, 20, 50 years ago, under rules and provisions that could never happen today, they failed to point out a number of other issues and the consequences of this bill. By all means, townships, and I'm sure my county counterparts will agree that we should be doing much better land use planning in the state of Minnesota than has occurred. I think that's true for most states in the nation.
We tend to do a lot of reactionary planning instead of advanced planning. That said, the problems that occur are occurring at all levels of government. It's not just a township or county issue. And if you'll allow me to walk through some of the specifics of this bill, I think you'll find that this bill does not solve the problems that have been identified.
Mr. Sulem, too, I hope, I know we had anecdotal information from the other testifiers, but I should have reminded them to really speak to the policy in the bill rather than just examples.
Madam Chair, I'll do my best to try to deal with the specifics.
Thank you. That's policy part. Thank you, Mr. Sulem.
The policy that's actually set forth in Section 1 of the bill is a policy we would support. That is the school siting piece. There are a number of situations where a school siting does trigger annexation battles because of the existing law, and we think that that provision does make a lot of sense. However, that provision is also in Senator Dibble's bill, which I believe has that already been to this committee, his greenhouse emissions. If not, I know it's coming.
Yes, it's already been here.
So that's why I thought we'd already been to this stop. And so that piece is moving in another vehicle, and if appropriate, I assume we'll end up in the appropriate education policy bill. But that is a policy provision that we definitely do support. Section 2 is a provision that the advocates did not even acknowledge is in the bill. This is a provision that's stating the policy that we should have no more incorporations of cities, period. Now, there may be some who think, well, we've got plenty of cities. What do we need more local government for? But let me point out that recently we've had about three new cities incorporated. Prior to that, we had a handful that were denied. The point is we have a policy on the book right now that says if a township wishes to incorporate it, they think they can make the case that it's more appropriate for them to be a city, there's a review process to allow that to happen. The cities are allowed to object. The counties are allowed to object. The surrounding communities are allowed to object. There's input from the residents. This just makes an arbitrary policy, no new cities. And I won't go into, unless you want more details, but I'll point out that the incorporation of the city of Columbus, formerly Columbus Township, is an example where the judge actually found the township incorporating was in the best interest of everybody and not the annexation that the city sought at the last moment to cherry-pick out the business part. The new Section 2 that was part of the A6 Amendment, and I'll try to keep the sections accurate. It's a little difficult. We're working on the third or fourth amendment in the last 12 hours. Not to mention the number of drafts that we've had since this bill began. But what I believe is Section 2 under the A6 amendment and Section 3, I believe Ms. Garlitz will address in more detail, but it is compatible with Sections 5 and, of the bill that creates this 1 in 40 density. Now, again, that's a policy that may sound very attractive of trying to preserve open space. However, it is just wrought with a number of unintended consequences. For example, just yesterday I had a former member of the legislative body, I believe from the other chamber, but I won't mention that because I know we don't talk that in this committee, but I believe he served in the other body. But he said that in the farm crisis of the 80s, the only way he could save his farm was to sell off a 7-acre section in order to raise enough revenue to stay afloat and save the farm in its entirety. And by being able to split off and sell 7 acres, he saved 120-some acres of farmland. Under this proposal, gone. That option's out the window, can't do it. We have been informed recently that a number of banks are now requiring farmers to split off the homestead portion of the farm into that 1 or 2 acre site in order to securitize the loans they need to plant the next round of crops or other farm loan needs. Couldn't do that under this bill because it would violate the 1 in 40 density ratios. Number of farmers like to have their children put up the second home and be able to move back onto the farm with mom and dad and eventually take over the farm. That would violate a 1 in 40 density. Couldn't do it under this policy. In addition, it's a policy that sets a one-size-fits-all approach to the entire state of Minnesota. And there are certainly areas of the state that we would like to see preserved as good farmland. There's areas of the state that we'd like to see preserved as open space for other purposes, but there are simply parts of the state that have already simply developed to a point where a 1 in 40 is no longer the practical approach to take. This removes the majority of flexibility for the counties and townships to determine what's in the best interest of the community as a whole. You heard last week from one of our testifiers about the small businesses that frequently get started in a township, and then as they expand and actually need services, then do move into the city limits. This would be a policy that would prohibit those small businesses from getting started. So it is not a very it sounds good on the surface, but the impact of the policy is very detrimental. Section 6 of the bill, and I believe both in the unofficial engrossment and the A6 amendment, while greatly expanding Section 6, I believe Section 6 is still this concept of a growth area. Let me be clear by stating that the townships actually proposed this concept back in 2005, not in the format you see before you, but the concept of saying we could resolve a lot of the disputes by being able to say, where do we, for communities that truly have the ability to extend sewer and water, and the capacity is there and the plans are in place, there's some legitimacy to saying let's protect some of that growth area and really try to encourage compact development. However, the bill that's before you today does a couple things. First of all, it says that there is a preliminary growth area of 2 miles on any side of the city. Now, that amounts to 8 square miles at least of growth area. I don't think there's a city in the state that could fill the 2 miles, much less 8 miles, if we're talking truly dense residential development. But they are taking 2 miles on all sides of the city and saying county is completely out of the picture, and at the township level, it is a 1 in 40 density, period. And there's until a growth area is officially established, that land is left in limbo. So if you've got a city that never wants a growth area, will never be doing anything, has no desire or no ability to have development within the city, you are now holding all the property outside those city limits in complete limbo, because the way this bill is drafted with the A6 amendment, absolutely nothing can happen in those 2 mile stretch. Outside of the 2 miles is still the 1 in 40, and then if the county jumps through a number of hoops that exceeds mostly what's required by current law, there are some minor exceptions that could happen. And so I'll conclude by saying again, we are more than happy to continue conversations about good planning and compact, dense development areas that are truly able to be served, where the capacity is there, not only a willingness to be provided, that's another part of this policy statement that the cities have put forth. The only thing that triggers the growth area is their willingness to extend services. There's absolutely no requirement that they ever do so. There's no requirement that they that the city density is actually an urban density as they would like to portray it. Anything less than 1 in 40 would be an urban density. So they could still have 2-acre lots, 5-acre lots, 10-acre lots. The very things they're telling you should not happen are exactly allowed as long as it's in the city limits. And there's a willingness someday that we'll think about services. This bill does not achieve the policy of dense, tight, clustered development on the fringes of the city. One last thing. In 2006 and then reiterated again in 2008, the legislature, both chambers, unanimously supported language that said that orderly annexation agreements would be the preferred approach for annexation, and that we should be doing more as a state to encourage cooperative efforts, joint efforts, such as the bill we just passed, Senator Roebling's bill, to say let's come together and figure out how to work together. Well, my view is that this bill would actually deter efforts to work together. And I received an email from Cannon Falls Township confirming exactly that. Within the past couple of weeks, they were ready to go out for hearing on their proposed OA agreement. 15 months worth of negotiations between two townships and the city of Cannon Falls. Just as they were doing the final review and drafting the notice provisions to go out to the public for the OA hearing that's required, the city of Cannon Falls notified them, pending outcome of House File 1035, Senate File 913, we are withdrawing from all negotiations. They feel that they are going to be better off because this bill would allow them to have unilateral control. The joint planning that is discussed is not as joint as it seems. Yes, there is a process to say that if the city requests, and only the city requests, a panel of 3 township members and a panel of 3 council members could start trying to create the growth area.
Mr. Sullivan, the proponents took about 15 minutes, and you've already gone over 10, right, and you have three other testifiers.
I will wrap up very quickly here, Madam Chair. Problem is that within that division, again, you've got three and three, and then the county would have some sort of veto power. It's not clear that when the county has veto power, they have to submit an alternative plan, but the bill doesn't really address what you do with that alternative plan. Does that become the growth area? Does it send it back to this joint effort? Then it creates this joint planning board, which is, if I track the amendment correctly, the township and the city, but they're playing by the city rules. So yes, there's a joint planning process, but the only rules that apply are the city rules. So it's not as joint as it appears. With that, I'll conclude my comments.
Okay, who's going to be next? And you'll have to be really, really brief to keep the fairness doctrine going here. Who's going to be next?
I'll try that. My name is Don Sherper, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify before your committee. I just want to make a few comments about the bill and maybe a couple suggestions afterwards. One is that the cities are not obligated to provide services to residents within the growth boundary within a prescribed time. That's a problem. The city is not required to change its growth boundary, even if the majority of residents affected want it changed. So I ask, where's the voice and the choice of the people in this process? Thirdly, the bill does not recognize the latest technologies available for individual septic systems, which can provide for better treatment in a more cost-effective manner than a large pipe to a central wastewater treatment center. No municipal incorporations are permitted after June 1st, 2009. This denies the opportunity for township residents to change their form of government. And this locks them into being unincorporated areas, leaving them vulnerable to annexation without a voice. Townships are the most efficient type of government where electors determine their own level of service and tax themselves to provide these services. Townships have not received local government aid for several years, but rely on local property taxes to help maintain over 57,000 miles of road, assure fire protection, and provide for the public health, safety, and welfare of its residents. This costs throughout the state a total of about $209 million for 1 year. And that's for all the townships providing those services for about 1 in 5 Minnesotans. These are tough economic times, and I would like you to turn around and see how far $209 million will go towards furnishing cities' residents their services. I think that this is a kind of a poor bill which would dismantle grassroots government and local control under the guise of reducing gas house emissions. And I urge you to reduce and reject this bill. I have a couple of suggestions. One is to review the final report of the Municipal Boundary Boundary Adjustment Task Force, not the Boundary Water one.
No,
this is Boundary Adjustment Task Force.
That's a whole other deal.
Yes, and we spent several months and many hours of meetings on that report, and I hope that the committee will review that and take it into consideration, and also review the goals and principles of 414.01, which are in the statutes right now. But one thing about it, if you read the report, you will see the contrast between the city and township viewpoints. And I have one last comment on sprawl, and that is that it's been mentioned, comes up every once in a while, but suburbanization in many instances is pejoratively called sprawl, which has a negative connotation. Sprawl is really suburbanization of the cities. many people will relocate for lower taxes, generally less crime and better schools, to an affordable home with a larger lot, provided they will have reasonable transportation and resources. And actually, sprawl is termed as being bad, but growth is good. But really, what's the difference?
Thank you very much, Mr. Sherper. Who's going to be next? And I'll ask you not to repeat any of the prior testimony. And you, you've gone over your 15 minutes, so you really need to be very brief.
I'll be as brief as possible. My name is John Seval. I work as a county planner for Sherburne County. I'm representing the County Board of Commissioners.
I do have a letter that the page will come and get it.
Okay. I do have a letter that goes along with my testimony. I do also have a map that was included in the letter. Oops, thanks. That I'd just like to display. There's three points I'd like to make and then explain two different scenarios of how I think this bill might affect zoning in Sherburne County. First, I do want to say that as we've reviewed these different versions of the bill within our office, it's been reviewed by planners, zoning administrators, billing officials, and attorneys. We've interpreted the language differently, even though it's the same language. It's been confusing to us. So the point that I want to make is that as staff members, it's our job to enforce the laws that you have written. If we can't understand it, we can't enforce it. So this bill, as it's currently written, in our opinion, is enforceable because it's too complex for us to understand. Three points that I want to make. One is that this bill attempts to establish a kind of one-size-fits-all zoning. It's assuming that what works in one area of the state is going to work in the other area. That's not how it works. Even within Sherburne County, we've tried to simplify zoning as possible. We have two primary zoning districts. Our western townships are zone 1 per 40. Our eastern townships are zone for 2.5-acre lots. That doesn't work well, and we're trying to work that out through our comprehensive planning and zoning regulations. So, once again, the one-size-fits-all zoning does not work. The point number two that I want to make is that this bill would require that all township areas beyond that 2-mile boundary of the city limits be zoned for one home per 40 acres. Once again, in Sherburne County, our western townships are already zoned for one per 40, and they actually have more restrictive zoning than what this bill is proposing. In our eastern townships, it would be such a drastic change to land use, it would be very similar to the Green Acres bill that was passed last year. One example that we have is currently the county board has approved or given preliminary plat approval to 220 residential lots. Under this bill, if those lots do not receive final plat approval and are recorded by the year 2011 or August of 2011, that plat agreement becomes voided and the land is going to be rezoned to 1 per 40. Our concern is that this becomes a takings, which is going to land us in court very quickly. So there's some legal issues with that. The third point that I'd like to make is, the state has really been pushing for local governments to try to combine services and becoming more efficient. What this map represents, and maybe I should explain a little bit, within Sherburne County, we have 10 townships and 7 cities. The county is the zoning authority for all 10 townships. So as far as zoning authorities go, we have 7 cities, 1 county, that's 8 different zoning authorities. If every city were to elect to create a city growth area with a joint zoning board between the city and the township, there's potentially 43 different zoning authorities, whereas right now we currently have 8. So that's 43 different zoning ordinances that we have to figure out what does it mean for every area. Currently if a landowner calls us up and says, what can I do on my land, our questions are, do you live in the city or the township? And then we figure out what zoning district they're in. On top of that, we're going to have to figure out what zoning board they're in, what zoning ordinance are being followed, what staff is working with that zoning board, and how does that meet. That starts playing into.
I'm going to ask you to wrap up,
sure,
if you will.
So that starts playing into how our 60-day rule works. The two examples I want to give as far as how this bill, if this bill were to pass as written, how does that affect Sherburne County? I don't know if this is realistic or not. All of our cities and townships have very good working relationships with each other. And I would say the exception would be with the Princeton-Baldwin Township that you heard a little bit further. I would think that most cities and townships would negotiate through an orderly annexation agreement. The orderly annexation agreement can accomplish the same thing that this bill does, and it's currently existing. The worst case scenario is this. So you know, what will likely happen then, it's hard to say, but this is, I don't think, what the authors were intending when it was written, but this is how we've interpreted that that could happen.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Seawall.
Thank you.
The opponents have gone way beyond what the proponents had, but I will take a couple of minutes of testimony from you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'd like to start out by thanking Senator Bach for here. Oh, my name is Annalee Garlitz,
thank
and I'm
you.
With the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I just wanted to thank Senator Bach for having numerous meetings with counties to hear our concerns. The bill has changed quite a bit since it has been introduced, and a lot of the technical questions that I've put forward on behalf of counties have been fixed, but not all of them. And I still have many questions, and Mr. Sulem covered some of those, so I won't go into detail on those. I do have some questions about what this would do to existing lots of record that have not yet been recorded. Stearns County wrote to me, indicated that they have thousands of these lots, and what would happen if they're not recorded by a particular date. They may not be able to be built upon. I also have a question on the Section 2, line 1.9, parcels classified as non-commercial, seasonal, residential, recreational property for property tax purposes. I've had several different zoning administrators.
Section 2 of the amendment.
Of the amendment,
correct?
Yes. I've had several different zoning administrators and some attorneys look at this language, and they've indicated that it would mean that somebody who has a homesteaded property, a farmer, or somebody that's living outside of a city area would not be exempt from the 1 per 40, but somebody who has a home that's classified as a seasonal rec property would be able to do things that somebody who has a homesteaded property wouldn't be able to do. And so in terms of countywide planning and zoning, tying something to a tax classification makes things a little bit difficult for what we have to carry out. And if we want people to follow the comprehensive plan, this adds a layer of confusion about property rights for different individuals and their property tax classifications. There are some, I appreciate the consideration that's been given to allowing counties to do additional work with their comprehensive plans if they would like to do more than one residence per 40 acres. However, there are some rather burdensome conditions in Section 3, and there are some very questionable ones, such as on line 2.6, before allowing development under this subdivision, the county must update its comp plan with an evaluation of the potential public infrastructure. So my question is, every time somebody comes forward with a development, the county might need to update their comprehensive plan. That's a question that remains from this new version of the bill. And then also the analysis of the transportation-related carbon emissions. The bill indicates that a commonly accepted methodology would need to be used, and I'm not certain what that is, where it exists, where county staff would go to find those commonly used, if somebody might disagree with what the county found. And then finally, I want to point out, I'll skip over some of the parts that Mr. Sulem commented on line 2.29, or in the part that starts on 2.29, it indicates that it will be the Joint Powers Board will consist of 3 city and 3 township residents. And I've had some kind of looking at this and wondering about county representation. The thing that we would like to encourage is coordination and cooperation and discussion between all the local units of government. And right now, a Joint Powers Board would be created of non-elected officials that would be governing this urban growth area. And counties, on the next page, would be given an opportunity to approve or reject the growth plan that's been determined by this board of unelected officials. And it says that if we oppose the plan, we could submit an alternative idea, but it doesn't indicate what happens. If the county submits an alternative plan, what does this group of unelected officials do with the county plan? So that was one of my other questions. And again, I just want to say I appreciate the work that's been done to make the changes in the bill, and counties continue to desire to participate in discussions, but we don't feel that the bill is in a place where we can support the language.
Thank you very much, Ms. Garlitz. We will now have a committee discussion on the bill. Are there questions or comments for Senator Bach. We would hope that we would not need to call back up any testifier, but that the committee would have a discussion now. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bach, I've been looking at this and trying to discern if the townships within the metropolitan area are included in under these provisions. I mean, currently those townships have to go through all the Metro Council plans and their rules for comprehensive plans, and it doesn't appear that they're excluded, the cities and
Senator
townships.
Senator Bach, are the metro townships included?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that
question.
Mr.
McGowan?
Madam Chair, yes, they are.
Yes, they are, Senator Roebling. Other comments, questions? Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, I just have a question for Mr. Blake, because he presented us some information. I just wanted to follow up, and if I may.
Just for answering a question, and we'll see whether, first of all, but Senator Bach can answer the question, but please be seated.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Blake, on that, when you presented us with this Wild Rose Estates, you made the comment that they're on well and septic. Now, the question I have for you, are they on individual well and septic, or is it a joint well and septic system?
Mr. Blake.
Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, the proposal as it sits right now is awaiting preliminary plat, and the proposal was to have some combination of individual and combined septic. We don't know the answer at this point in time. The city was attempting to prevent it from moving forward.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Senator Olsen?
Well, Madam Chair, I think that's important because joint rural developments with a joint sewer and water are very efficient developments, and so I think that was, I don't think that should have been left out of the comments. That's my only comment.
Okay, thank you. Is there further discussion? Senator Day.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, you're a wonderful senator, but this is not one of your best bills, I don't think. And it is interesting in that I live in a city and you live on a lake up north, which, and I also am probably going to be talking against at least three-fourths of my constituents because they live in cities. But I know what my people in my cities think, and annexation and the things with counties and cities have, with Senator Vickerman and Senator Hottinger, we kind of leveled that off, and actually I think over a long period of time they got together, and it's good. As for somebody talking about emissions, it almost seems to me like where I'm at, it's like I'm in Montana or Wyoming, and where Minneapolis and St. Paul is, it's Minneapolis and St. Paul. So as far as emissions and quality of life and all those things, if people are out what you might call sprawl, and they live out in all these townships and out around, I don't think that's all bad. When somebody talks to me about schools, I went through a whole bunch of consolidations of schools talking about the cities lost their schools because they couldn't afford their schools, and we have to run buses to three or four cities. So somebody says that. Then somebody brings up Princeton. Well, I know Princeton, and I know the township they're talking about. That's home of the Wergans and the Copen Dryers and that whole bunch. I've been to many places out in there. You know, why would that group of people want to move into Princeton? They're living out there. They pick to live out there. Why move into Princeton? The people in Sartell. You know, the people in Sartell, I used to do a little carousing up in that area and used to go to Gilligan's. And Gilligan's with north of Sartell. There are all these people that live on the river. And they got these housing projects that are near the river. Why did they want to go there? Quality of life. Quality of life. I mean, it seems that, and I know the housing projects that they had in Sartell. Somebody said status quo is, we just can't keep status quo. Why not? If this is a driving force just for cities to say that everybody has to live in a city in Minnesota, my goodness, I don't know about that. It doesn't seem right. With the downturn and everything, There's a combination of things that are happening out here. Like, it used to be people would annex, the city would go out and try and annex into the township. They don't have to anymore because nobody's building, so they all have 1,000 or 2,000 lots in most of these smaller cities around, so there's a lot of building lots. So I just, when I look at the bill and I'm thinking, why would we want to put limits and tell everybody that they have to all live together? When I drive by places that are 20 stories high and they're packed with people and people tell me that that's a quality of life and they are helping the emissions and they're helping the gas and they're helping whatever. I just don't buy into it. I'm like you. I want to someday get on Lake Vermilion. I'm like you, quality of life guy. So I don't understand why you want to force everybody to live in a city.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Day, I'm moving into the 26th floor in one of those big high-rise buildings.
Madam Chair, God help
Madam
you,
Chair,
Sandy.
I feel like this is still work in progress. We know that, and we hope that Senator Bach will continue to work with all parties. Every session we have a couple bills like this that we can't get it all right at each committee stop, but we give the parties a chance to express their opinions and their concerns, and Senator Bach heard you, I'm sure, and we'll continue to work on this. But I think we really should move this bill along to the next stop, and I'd like to move that Senate File 913 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to Finance.
Is there a further discussion of that motion? Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, as I did a lot for townships and counties in my political career here, I think this is a work in progress, a step ahead. Senator Bach, I got a lot of faith in you, and I want your word that this bill will keep continuing to work, and can we make it better?
Senator Madam Bach. Chair, Senator Vickerman, I live in a township. But, Senator Vickerman, on Sunday morning, when my wife and I, we were down here, when we went to church, we took a little different route last Sunday, and we go to a church just north of Centerville. We went up Highway 61, and we turned across on a county road, and I didn't know where we were going to come out, but when we hit Highway 35E, I could see the interchange where E and W split off, and interesting, driving across on that county road, it was dotted with new homes and agricultural fields, and I don't know if they were 5-acre lots or 10-acre lots, whatever they were, and I have to tell you, I just thought to myself, this is not a good land use pattern, and this is a rural guy. It just doesn't seem to be a good utilization of our land, and I think as we think out looking forward, we can do better than that. And there's a lot of work to be done here, and I don't know if we can get there or not this year, but I think keeping the sides at the table is helpful. And the issue's been around a long, long time, and I don't know if we can get there. But I'm not, Senator Vickerman, I don't want to do anything that's harmful to townships. I live in one.
We're going to vote on Senator Day, the people who are here for the next bill, some of them who are interpreters, need to leave at 5:30.
Good. They'll like to hear what I got to say.
Okay. Senator Day.
We talk about these townships up north. We're talking about woods and underbrush. Come on down in my area, and it's black dirt farm, from one edge of every farm to the other farm. But even in our area, in the state of Minnesota, we have hundreds of thousands of acres that we're not farming. So when somebody says we're using up all the farmland because somebody is out on their farm and their son and daughter or somebody wants to come out and put another house on the next door to them and they can't, just because, it's anyway.
Okay, thank you, Senator Day. Senator Pappas renews her motion that Senate File 913, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. And to everybody here, I will commit to keep working on this, and I'm not sure.
What did you say? It passed or failed?
I said it prevailed.
prevail.
We'll keep working on it. I'm not sure if we'll ever get anything to the floor, but we'll keep trying. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1600 is a proposal to set technology standards in the statutes and the sections of the law that deal with standards for technology. And we want to, in this bill, include accessibility. And I would direct your attention to the duties of the commissioner to gather people together, to adopt rules, to discuss the rules, to bring accessibility into standards that are applicable to software, hardware, technology, and how that would play out in making this 24/7 government that we want to have available to all Minnesotans truly be available to all Minnesotans instead of not being available to 10% of Minnesotans who are deaf, hard of hearing, deaf, blind. I want to, in particular, begin with a testimony, which I know is unusual, of a member of the House, Representative Westrum. I have, I believe, with one exception, asked every member of this committee if they would be agreeable to making an exception to a tradition of the Senate, where we do not usually invite or welcome members of the House. Representative Westrum, there I go. Representative Westrum really has a unique viewpoint as a colleague and an elected public official, and his needs to have the same kind of accessibility to technology, hardware, software, as all the rest of us. So your indulgence, even before I get to amendments, et cetera, that I would ask you to call upon Representative Westrum for his testimony.
Representative Westrum, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will respect the rules of the Senate. And I did wear a tie just so
you forgot your wig and robe, though.
I did forget the wig, but I consciously made sure I brought a tie because some days I don't. I wear shirts that don't allow me to wear ties in the House because of the body we purport to be. Mr. Chair, members, I will be brief, but I do appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. When Ms. Harnack came by to discuss this bill with me, I said something on the order of amen, in the sense that this is something that is long overdue, in my opinion. I lost my eyesight in a car accident in 1987, for those of you that maybe weren't aware of that. Prior to that, I would not have thought about accessibility and how to access things. What I have got here in front of me, what they call a slate, and this is a stylus. This is a slate. This is a stylus. There's a piece of paper here. What you would do is you'd put this over the paper, and this little stylus is what you would punch Braille dots with. Members, we are not talking about that type of accessibility issues today. The 21st century, there's many that use Braille much less than
we used it even 10 or 20 years ago. While that's still a very meaningful way to read or to have tactile, what we are talking about in many cases and what I use in the house in my own private business, I probably already violated one of your rules. I know I didn't identify myself, Tori Westrom, a member of the House of Representatives. But I have adaptive speech on my computer, and it reads back to me what is on the screen, what comes in the email, what comes in the bills. But it doesn't just do it automatically. It is a constant struggle. Every time we update, in fact, or talk to our tech staff, I hate updating anything in the House electronically, because 9 times out of 10, and that's my own opinion, but it's probably not far from the truth, it will not work with my adaptive speech, because the software planners have not thought about making it adaptive, and the person purchasing it hasn't requested or required that of the software salesperson when they've went ahead with the purchase order. And so simply what this bill would do would have an advisory committee bring forth these ideas. There are standards with websites. There are standards with electronic softwares and the computer age that we live in. And it, I would support, and I would urge you to support, and I will be urging the House members to support us moving ahead with this. A quick anecdotal story. When I went through law school, I'm a lawyer by trade in my private life, but I just had this discussion with the courts a couple of weeks ago. But 5 years ago, when I was 6 years ago, when I was finishing law school, I was doing some research on a court of appeals case. The easiest way for me to get that case was to go to the courthouse or the court of appeals just down the road here. Bring my reader, take the big thick briefs that they have, go get a photocopy of them, and then have to sit down and read them with a reader. In this day and age, most of those briefs, and I dare say all of those briefs, are coming electronically from Microsoft Word, from WordPerfect, or some electronic form from the from the attorney's office that are filing these. It's time we get our systems up to date and improve and require an electronic filing system, as well as if they want to file paper, that's fine. It would take one stroke of the computer to send that file by email as well, and make it accessible for somebody like myself that wants to read it through speech, or I dare say others that even have sight that would like to get that electronic copy because they wouldn't want to have to drive into the cities to get that file, et cetera, et cetera. There's movement in that direction, but that is still the way many of the court of appeals and cases in our court systems are filed today. And so there's lots of room for improvement to making things accessible. And it really comes down to, at the beginning, just require it as part of the purchase order in the first place. I have brought forth a couple amendments over the years in our rules in the House to try to address this issue. It is changed. We've made progress. But I tell you that if we could have a uniform standard, it would be easier, I think, for all the tech support people, all the persons purchasing. And it is out there. It's accessible. It's available. It's just somebody's got to require it up front and ask for it. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd stand for any questions, but I appreciate your indulgence, and I would urge your support of this bill. My parting comment would be, don't go too easy on it, just because it seems like it's moving mountains to get people to recognize and ask for this type of accommodations or accessibility to be a feature of software or web designs when they're purchasing them.
Thank you, Representative Westrom. Interesting. I'm wondering, is the technology available that would help you read the way our legislation is drafted, with the underlines and the strikeouts and the page and line, you know, to engross them yourself as sighted folks do at the table? I mean, those are a lot of skills and tools that we use our eyes for, and I'm just curious, is the technology all there for that?
Mr. Chair, the short answer is yes. What I've actually had to do in the House is one of our staff persons in House Research has actually written the macro for my computer to recognize, and it announces underline begin and underline end as it goes through those. I dare say there's a better feature out there. You might have gotten a copy of a news release that Ms. Harnack sent around, and in there I use the word guinea pig. There's only so much time in my day and week and year that I have to be a guinea pig, and so sometimes I just don't let perfect stand in the way of good, and if it's working, I don't spend time finding more. But the short answer is yes, but part of this idea would be there would be collaboration up front. And for instance, when Microsoft comes out with a new release, a new version, the problem gets to be they don't want to release this to I use a program called JAWS Speech just for an illustration purpose. They don't want to release their new release to Freedom Scientific, the owner and the creator of this JAWS speech program, until it's out. And they've gotten better at starting to pre-release these to companies that write adaptive speech software. But upon a state of Minnesota and other entities that are purchasing large volumes of this, I dare say it's going to help put the pressure on Microsoft to make sure they have these arrangements in place 6 months before they're going to release, that they say, okay, Freedom Scientific, under confidentiality, we'll let you debug this and work with what we're coming out with. But the problem, and it's gotten some better, not solved yet, but it's gotten some better. But the problem often is that they don't do that until after the fact because the marketplace isn't asking them to do that. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden the people at Freedom Scientific or working with JAWS have to work like crazy to try to figure out how to make the JAWS speech work with the new adaptions. And that's why I never want to be the one to be upgraded, and I'm always the last one in the house because I asked to be last, because maybe after, if I drag my feet for 6 months or 12 months, they'll have the bugs worked out of the adaptive speech. But that's usually not the way it is. PDFs are another scenario that we just found a piece of software last week, in fact, MyLA, that will convert those back to a Word document. But that's some of the guinea pig-ish stuff that I get to do. And certainly I expect it can happen, but this would go a long ways in helping everybody be able to access documents and websites.
I think in the technology world, you can just call it beta if you have trouble with guinea pig. But Senator Rust, you had other testifiers? Did any other members have questions?
Well, I wanted to, in respect of Representative Westrom's time as a schedule as a House member, to have him go first, and then I'd like to just spend a couple minutes explaining the bill, and I have an author's amendment, and then we can take
other questions of Representative Westrom while he's with us. Senator Carlson.
Yeah, Representative Westrom and Mr. Chair, is there a bellwether state or municipality or anyone who has led the state of the art in this that you're aware of?
Representative Westrom.
I'm not aware of that. Might be a better question for Ms. Harnack or one of the later testifiers. I understand there are some other states that have went down the road of passing this or have already passed it. So might be a question to ask later. I'm not the right one to answer that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to then thank Representative Westrom for sharing his experiences with the software that is available, or the lack thereof, for enabling him or to carry out his duties as an elected representative.
Yes, thank you for the perspective, Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and senators, and I feel honored.
Senator Rust, on
Mr.
the
Mr.
bill.
Mr. Chairman, I do have the A1 amendment.
This is an author's amendment?
Yes, it is.
Senator Rust moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, just briefly, what that A1 amendment did was to delete Section 4 of the bill, which set forward the accessibility standards and replace it with different language, in particular that it would be the chief information officer that would be responsible for the development of those standards and not the commissioner of administration. And then it also added
one member to this working group, which is to be a staff member from the legislature, appointed by the chair of the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and then encourages the appointing authorities to make their best efforts, to use best efforts to ensure that the membership of the advisory committee include at least one representative from the affected groups. So that's what that did. And then there was a technical correction in the last section of the bill with regard to the effective date. So in brief, Mr. Chairman, the state over the next 2 years with the work of this task force would come up with standards for software, hardware, all technology that is responsive to the issues of accessibility, and report back to the legislature, members of the appropriate committees, January 15th of each year, regarding the findings, progress, and recommendations made by them, and also, as we've done before, including in their recommendations any draft legislation. And the we ask for those appointments to be made by August 1st of this year. The CIOs or his designee would convene the first meeting, and that the committee would elect a chair at the first meeting of the committee. And then there is a appropriation section that comes from the Telecommunications Access Fund, Minnesota Fund, to provide support for this group, $100,000 each year for coordinating technology, accessibility, and usability, $100,000 each year to the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans to provide information on their website in American Sign Language and to provide technical assistance to the state agencies, and $100,000 each year to the LCC for a pilot program to provide live streaming of legislative sessions on the commission's website, because we don't have that available now as it is. And although we might not think that citizens are interested in our legislative hearings, so we know that I think we know that they need to have the right to either tune us in or tune us out, and right now 10% of Minnesotans don't have that that opportunity. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd like to invite whoever else from the communities is here for brief testimony.
Absolutely. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jamie Taylor. I'm the Access and Technology Specialist for the Commission of Deaf, Deaf Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. I should also probably let you know that I'm perfecting my skills at pretending to be able to see and hear you, because I'm deafblind. And also, I should let you know that this is my first time testifying on behalf of the commission, so please wish me good luck, and I thank you.
You're doing great.
Now, why I am mostly here testifying for is to give a brief overview of what 508 and WCAG, or Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, means. 508 is a portion of a federal law that requires that all federal employees and members of the public with disabilities have access to and use of the same information and data that people in the public and federal employees without disabilities have at the federal level, of course, and it doesn't create what is called an undue burden. WCAG web content accessibility guidelines are created, well, is created by the World Wide Web Consortium, or W3C, which is the main international standards organization for the World Wide Web. Now, 508 and WCAG are very compatible with each other, but WCAG deals strictly with the web and accessibility. So, and it also has more specific standards and guidelines, and has three different levels to accessibility. The advisory committee will determine which level meets the most accessibility for the state and also doesn't create an undue burden. In your packets, you should have more information about 508 and WCAG. And I thank you for allowing me to testify today. And to answer your question, yes, there are other states that are doing similar things, as well as the federal government, which has 508 right now. The other states are, for example, Oklahoma, which does closed caption every hearing. And so that just tells you there is a demand, and it's really fun. You can actually watch everything, including for lower sessions and committee hearings. And they even go above and beyond that and do judicial hearings. So with that in mind, thank you very much. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Taylor. Senator Rust, you had additional testifiers?
Is there anybody who wants to speak?
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alicia Lane Outlaw. And I would like to thank you for allowing me to testify today, and especially to Senator Rust for introducing this bill. It's a very opportune time to do this. And my name is Alicia Lane Outlaw. I'm here today as a citizen, as a community organizer, and a professional web designer who happens to be deaf. I'm going to use the internet as an example when I speak to you about how technology accessibility impacts my life. The early days of the internet were just a huge boon for me. Just about everything on the internet was accessible to me as text or images. My company and my clients have benefited from my ability to go online and to acquire knowledge and skills that I would otherwise not have had access to. I am able to earn a good salary and rely less on government support services for the disabled because of that. My spouse, my daughter, parents, and siblings have all benefited from my ability to retrieve all sorts of government service information and make educated decisions affecting their lives. The same is true for the community and others like me. Now, that was then. This accessibility, unfortunately, has been steadily decreasing since videos and podcasts were introduced. So it really is time for accessibility standards to catch up with technology. The timing really couldn't be better. Accessibility is a current hot topic among technology professionals. Just yesterday, I received a newsletter for web professionals, and that newsletter was praising the new WCAG 2.0 accessibility standards because they made them much more readable for web designers. New resources are also appearing daily. those new and soon-to-come resources will really lower the cost of implementing accessibility standards. New technologies open amazing new possibilities, and nobody deserves to be shut out. I really urge you to just nip this problem in the bud and pass this bill to open that door of technological possibilities for all of us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lane. Senator Rust?
Mr. Chairman, I believe we have one more person.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
I am Steve Jacobson. I currently am the Vice President of the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota, and I'm here substituting for our President, Jennifer Dunham. I also happen to serve as the Vice President of our National Computer Science Division. And I'm aware of time constraints, so we'll make this quick. In the late 1990s, when the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota introduced the first access to technology legislation here in Minnesota, we saw the beginnings of a serious problem. We, blind people particularly, were being excluded from jobs, not because we couldn't perform the job functions, but because of the technology that was purchased. Now that 10 years have passed, we know more where technology is going. And the tools that we use, which we are not asking you to provide in this legislation, like Representative Westrum mentioned JAWS, those tools have matured. And there are now federal standards, as have been mentioned, that we can now leverage that we couldn't 10 years ago. We need to make it clear, though, that what we are really asking you to do is to pick from the software that you already use that happens to be compatible with our equipment. That software that is not compatible will get the idea and make themselves compatible when they see that governments are buying software that's compatible. I use Microsoft Word and many of the other software packages and technologies that all of you use. What about cost, though? Building access into the process of purchasing is cheaper and more effective than having to handle an ADA complaint after the fact. Blind and other disabled people are employed, and we become taxpayers. Private industry is also impacted, and jobs are created where the same technologies are used. Please vote to adopt this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Senator Rust, it appears we have one more witness who wishes to testify. Welcome to the committee. Yep.
This chair here.
Okay. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Bell, and I am, I am chair of the Advocacy and Legislation Committee of the American Council of the Blind of Minnesota. I'm testifying in support of this bill, and in all candor, let me state first that it's not all that frequently that the American Council of the Blind and the National Federation of the Blind agree on legislation, but this is one of those cases. my second point is that probably a lot of us in this room are members of the baby boom generation, and as such, we are expanding the demographics of older people. Right now, I believe, if my memory serves me, people 65 and older currently make up about 12% of the state's population, and that's expected to grow to about 21%. One of the things about aging is that stuff happens as we get older, and that includes vision impairment and hearing impairment. Some people don't have those circumstances, but many will. So we will have more hearing impaired and visually impaired people in the state, and that's another reason to take this next important step and pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bells. Senator Rust.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony, and I would stand for questions on the bill. I do think it's pretty straightforward.
Pretty straightforward bill. Any questions from members?
Seeing none, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1600 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Rust moves Senate File 1600 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rust. Do you have
Mr.
a preference?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to take 446 next.
On File 446, Senator Rust.
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the subcommittee report.
Senator Sieben moves the subcommittee report on Senate File 446. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is a bill that proposes for Minnesota to become part of the National Popular Vote Compact Agreement. And we did have extensive testimony on it in the subcommittee. And for those that aren't on that subcommittee, just a brief overview. First of all, as I mentioned, it does provide for Minnesota to become part of the member states of an agreement that would elect the president by national popular vote. There have been many attempts, discussions about how we can go about respecting the popular vote as opposed to the process of the Electoral College to make sure that the person who becomes president of the United States actually got the most votes cast in an election. The agreement takes place or takes effect when enough states to cumulatively possess a majority of the electoral votes for a president and actually enact the agreement. And the agreement then requires that each state to determine what the national popular vote total is and then to designate a slate of presidential electors associated with a candidate with the highest national popular vote total as that national popular vote winner. And then the states would be required to certify the appointment of the presidential slate of electors determined to be the national popular vote winner as the duly elected presidential electors. That is the base of the bill. It's not all that that long. And I have one testifier, and I know that there's someone here who wants to testify against it. Mr. Sokol is here on
Mr.
behalf
Sokol,
of the bill.
Mr. Sokol, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Larry Sokol. I'm with the National Popular Vote Organization. I appreciate the opportunity to come and testify before the full committee, as I was here several weeks ago testifying before the subcommittee. Senator Rest did a wonderful job of explaining the basics of the bill. There are two specific issues that I would like to address in a little bit more detail because they're understandably questions that often come up when people are learning and discussing the National Popular Vote proposal. One is the issue of constitutionality. One of the questions we get all the time is this constitutional? Is this the proper way to do this? Don't you need a constitutional amendment? Questions along those lines. And I'm here to tell you that we are, at the risk of making a bad pun, supremely confident that this is constitutional. Matter of fact, very few, if any, of our opponents across the country even question the constitutionality of the proposal. And the reason why is the National Popular Vote Bill is based on two provisions that exist in the Constitution currently. The first is that states have exclusive and plenary authority to award their electoral votes however they choose. And the second is the ability of states to enter interstate compacts. So those are two provisions that are in the Constitution right now. Our proposal simply combines those two and is the interstate compact that Senator Rest just explained. It's also worth noting that from a historical perspective, virtually every electoral change of any consequence in U.S. history has happened as a result of state action and, frankly, not through the constitutional amendment process. Perhaps the best example, and this is something that I didn't realize until I became involved with National Popular Vote, is that there's nothing in the federal Constitution that guarantees any of us a right to vote for president. The members of the committee can vote for president because the state of Minnesota has said you can vote for president. It's not in the federal Constitution. That is an electoral change that came about as a result of state action, the state of Minnesota making that change. The elimination of property ownership requirements, the elimination of poll taxes, literacy tests, those all came about as a result of state action and not through the constitutional amendment process. Perhaps the best example that people point to is women's suffrage. Women's suffrage ultimately became a constitutional amendment, but prior to that, more than half the states in the country had already given women the right to vote through the state process, and it was only after more than 30 states had given that right to women that the 19th Amendment was approved by Congress. Similarly, the direct election of U.S. senators followed a similar path, where states first made that change and then subsequently led to a constitutional amendment. So we feel like the way that we're proceeding to try and get this change to a direct national popular vote for president is the right way to go. It's through state action, taking it through two state legislatures and having them adopt the proposal. The other issue which I'd like to discuss is the question of recounts. Understandably, here in Minnesota, given what's happened with the U.S. Senate race, there's been some concern about what would happen in the event of a close presidential election, what would happen with the need for a national recount if one were to come about, given the fact that our bill doesn't specifically address that need. Well, and the reason why our bill doesn't address that need is because it's already addressed. Every state in the country already has procedures in place to provide for a statewide recount if it's necessary. This is not something that needs to be created whole scale. It's something that already exists in every state's existing election law. The other thing which I want to point out is that the potential need for a recount in a presidential election is actually diminished significantly, arguably exponentially, by moving to a national popular vote. And let me explain what I mean by that. Currently, presidential elections are essentially 51 separate elections, the election in each of the 50 states as well as the District of Columbia. And in those circumstances, the vote totals in each of those individual states has a dramatic outcome on the overall election. As we all learned, or perhaps were reminded in 2000, 537 votes in the state of Florida in one state essentially determined the leader of the free world, despite the fact that on a nationwide level, the popular vote election was not particularly close. It was more than 100 times that margin of victory. At the same token, in 2004, if 60,000 votes in just one state, in the state of Ohio, had swung from President Bush to Senator Kerry, Senator Kerry would have carried the Electoral College despite losing the national popular vote by more than 3.5 million people. So the current system actually lends itself to these so-called crises because the winner of each individual state becomes relevant, and so therefore 500 votes in one state can flip enough electoral votes to change the outcome of the election. Under a national popular vote, that dynamic changes dramatically because you no longer have the 51 separate vote counts that are relevant. It's really just one pool of votes that is 125 million votes large. And the potential of an election of 125 million people being close enough to warrant a recount are astronomical. Independent research group Fair Vote in Washington completed a study a couple of months ago where they looked at statewide elections as perhaps the best example to look to towards a presidential election. They examined every statewide election for the last 26 years, more than 7,000 statewide elections, and according to their data, a statewide recount currently happens once every 300 Okay. Got it. Once every 332 elections, which if you translate that to a presidential election, means that you would have a presidential election close enough where you would have a recount once every 1,300 years. So while I understand the concern about recounts, we think that the need for a recount or the potential for recount actually goes down dramatically under the national popular vote proposal.
Yeah.
Be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
No questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sokol. Any questions of members before we move on to the opposition?
Mr. Davies wants to testify.
Yes. Mr. Davies, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jack Davies, and I'm here appearing today entirely on my own behalf. I've been interested in the stability of presidential elections for many years. In fact, in 1992, I proposed to the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, which have nothing to do with my appearance today. I want you to understand that. That we address the problem of the faithless elector. And I'm going to Chicago tomorrow at noon about to attend the first meeting of a committee on the faithless elector. I just give that to you so that you understand that this is not a new concern of mine, the stability of presidential elections. When I first heard of the national popular vote proposal, my first thought was, well, how do they handle recounts in the proposal? And my second thought was, how do they handle the problem if somebody if a state proposes to withdraw from the compact? Well, I just had those as academic concerns until I read another story about the national popular vote. So I popped the compact up on the computer and read it. And I was astounded in two respects. One, there is no mention of recount whatsoever in the whole compact. In my view, it's swept under the rug. Now, you just heard the suggestion that the risk of a recount need is reduced. Well, in fact, it's not reduced, because under the national popular vote, one factor creates the need for a recount in every state in the union, whether it's a member of the compact or not. If the votes of the compact states will be determined by the popular vote in non-compact states. And a non-compact state in no way is compelled or interested in having a recount. They're not going to be dragged around with a ring in their nose. So the compact states are going to say, who got the majority vote? Who got the majority vote when there very suspicious circumstances? Shall I pick a state? Louisiana. And no recount. Suspicious circumstance on the south side of Chicago, and no recount. Suspicious circumstance, do I need to go on? I don't have to go on. The suggestion was that it was reduced. Now you need a recount in a presidential election when there are two factors. One factor is that the electoral vote can be determined by a single state's electoral votes. And the second factor is that in one of those states with the controlling electoral votes, it's a close election. The example, of course, is Florida. Florida had the swing votes electorally and had a close popular vote. But those were two factors working together at the same time in the same election. Okay. I'm really the reason I came today more than anything else was I was so concerned about the state that has just gone through this recount procedure, being one of the states that moved forward on this proposition. The recount problem is just devastating. The second problem is the withdrawal problem. A state votes for candidate A. The popular vote nationally is for candidate B. Candidate A, a member of the compact, is told that it must vote for the popular vote winner, so long as it stays in the compact. So what does the compact say? You can't withdraw during a period where your vote, your state's vote, electoral vote, would be decisive. It's a contract remedy. What court in the world, what court can enforce that provision? If a state decides at that moment that it wants to cast its electoral votes according to its state's voters, not the national vote, if it withdraws, I cannot imagine how you can enforce the provision that's in the compact. So my bottom line is this won't work, so don't do it. It's dangerous, it's scary, it won't work. It will lead, it threatens an instability in our political system nationwide. It threatens that instability, which is the worst danger you can have in an electoral system, is an instability. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Davies. Senator Rust, any responses to the two issues?
Mr. Chairman, I think the issue of the recount was addressed, and I do believe that states have the authority, responsibility, privilege of entering into legally binding compacts. So I don't take that. I don't see that would that because this one deals with the national popular vote, that precludes, that says, well, this compact is not one that's going to stand up in court, but all the others are. So
so there have been courts that have heard other
in terms of compact issues? Yes, there are any number of interstate compacts. Mr. Chairman, I don't think there were any amendments to the bill, and I'm not sure that it needs Ms. Schaefer-Pellinen, the bill is favorable. It just goes to the floor. Is that right? We didn't have a request anywhere else.
To the floor, I believe.
Mr.
Yes.
Chairman, I would move that Senate File 446 be recommended to pass.
Senator Rust moves Senate File 446 be recommended to pass. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have one last bill. It will be very, very brief. It is Senate File 1464. There seems to be a prohibition about for employees in the Capitol building and in the state office building from gathering together to do exercising. And so what this bill does is to allow the entities like our employees to, in the executive, legislative, or judicial branch, to use space under that control, so in the Capitol or over in the SOB, to offer fitness, wellness, or similar classes or activities to its employees. Right now they cannot do that. They couldn't do it even when they tried to do it this summer during the interim. And allow persons conducting these classes or activities to charge employees a fee to
participate. And the authorization would apply to all state space, and the persons who would be conducting the classes or activities and participating employees would waive any and all claims of liability. This bill needs to go to the Judiciary Committee for any damage or injury arising from those activities. And the persons conducting the activities or classes would agree to indemnify, save, and hold the state, its agents, and employees harmless. And it also allows for the Commissioner of Public Safety or provides to for him to amend the rules and any other rules in 725.0400 and any other rules as necessary to conform to Section 1. The issue was Senator Ortman's. Senator Ortman's L.A. is a certified yoga instructor, and employees, the Senate employees, wanted to get together for a yoga class that she volunteered to lead in the state office building. There is a facility there, not very much used, but a facility there that is adaptable for that, and they were told it's against the law. So what this does is just allow them to get together, either volunteer or if somebody wants to lead a class, and they can do it on the state space. And I think it was mostly an issue of liability. So this bill would allow them to have their volunteer yoga classes. So I don't have anybody to testify.
Help you out with that. Where's Senator Ortman's L.A.?
Well, I'm sure she's busy working.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach, what you're saying is this bill will add some flexibility.
There it would be, Senator Gerlach. That's right. So,
Senator Rust, on line 1.8, you say an entity. We're really talking about people.
Like,
it sounds like. I mean,
like the Senate or the House or the Office of the Legislative Auditor or. That's what I think that means, Mr. Bodden. That's what it refers to when we say that.
Senator, that's correct.
So each of us is an entity as well unto ourselves, I guess, and we could.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's referring to the either agencies or, Senator Rest said, to the Senate or the House. It's the entity that would have control over the facility.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman and members, I don't know of anybody who opposes allowing our employees to get together under these circumstances. In fact, it is indeed, for fitness and wellness, and we should be encouraging that.
Excellent. Okay. Any other questions of members?
And Mr. Chairman, I don't know where this bill goes. Oh, this bill goes to Judiciary because it
involves
liability.
Senator Rust moves Senate File 1464.
1464.
Recommended to pass and referred to the Judiciary
Committee.
All those in favor of that motion, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
You may adjourn the committee.
There being no further business, the committee stands adjourned.